Welcome to another edition of Shedding Light here at KZSU, and the show that every Monday for an hour tries to shed lights on some current event that we all might need to know about. And I thought in the wake of, it wasn't a celebration, in the wake of the remembrance of the tragedy in New Orleans, in the wake of the remembrance of the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina and the non-response by the government, I thought we'd do today is talk to two activists that have been on the ground. They're residents and former residents of New Orleans. Well, they live there now. And they've been on these airwaves before. And we find out what's really going on unfiltered. And New Orleans still needs as much help as it can get in not the areas that the news media tells us about. It's other areas. And on the phone with us right now, live from New Orleans, is founder of Common Ground Relief, Malik Rahim. Welcome back to KZSU, Malik.
All right, Bert. It's nice being on your show, bro. It's always an honor.
You sound good. I heard you on KPFA a couple weeks ago. We got out of touch for a minute, but you sound in real good spirits, and I know you've been fighting the good fight down there. So much, for lack of, no pun intended, but so much water has gone under the bridge since we spoke last. There's just more than enough stuff to talk about. But Malik, can you kind of give a snapshot, bird's eye view of life in New Orleans now? I know it's not all right. It's not like everything's okay 5 years later. How is life in New Orleans for the average person?
I would say it's, it's still basically very a tale of two cities. You know, if you're white or if you're black and privileged, everything is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're poor and basically those who are no longer tolerated by this city, then it's like the hurricane have just hit. You know, have nothing really changed. You know, you couldn't tell that to anybody in public housing who have lost their home. You couldn't tell it to those that are still unemployed in the midst of a construction boom, you know. So it's all according on, which perspective you're looking at the city through.
Mm-hmm. And now you are a true grassroots community organizer. A lot of people, some people might not know, you founded Common Ground Relief, which was an organization that basically you found yourself, your house didn't get flooded, so you didn't get displaced, so you went out and started saving lives as much as you could. You were on your bicycle. You ended up founding an organization with a bunch of kids that showed up and other folks.
A bunch of them right here now helping me move.
Do you? That's great.
Volunteer. Wait a minute. I'm gonna let them just say their name and where they're from.
Okay. Who are we speaking to here? You're live on Stanford Radio.
I was Zach from upstate New York, Binghamton.
All right.
Alex from Santa Cruz, California.
All right, Alex. Santa Cruz is in the house.
Christina from Sarasota, Florida.
All right, Christina, cool.
Tom from Huntington, West Virginia.
Wow, these are volunteers across the board.
Peter from New Orleans.
Wow, helping out Common Ground Relief.
Yeah, well, they are helping me, because, like I said, I'm closing up our environmental center. We couldn't get any support from it from outside. They're saying about how nobody cares about Common Ground Relief. But I just want you to meet some individuals that's down here steady making a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And getting the job done. And they've been over here for 2 days now working with me on closing up our environmental center.
Uh-huh. Malik, as a former Black Panther, as a former community organizer that even lived and fought the good fight here in East Palo Alto, you lived out here for a while, you were actually put in prison, I believe it was Angola, over your political activity. Is that true?
No, I was in New Orleans Parish Prison. I did prison time in California.
Okay. So yeah. for a guy that's come from that background and then starting Common Ground, it must have really, because it would be easy to be bitter from where you've come from, but I imagine that you've gained quite a bit of hope seeing all these volunteer kids that have come down to work with you over these past 5 years. How did that affect your life and your outlook?
Well, I'm gonna tell you, I am very bitter. I'm very bitter about the so-called progressive movement in America that allow Brandon Darby and other provocateurs just to have victory. I'm very bitter of those that are saying that we are not doing nothing at Common Ground when we have individuals that are constantly making sacrifices to assist residents. I am very bitter when I see that everybody else who have ran out when the hurricane hit come back and they are recognized for the heroic deeds that they done, when we have these individuals that came all over from all over the United States and really globally and cannot get any form of recognition. Yeah, I am very bitter.
Okay. And you have every right to be, for sure. And I appreciate the fact of how you talked about the progressive community, because a lot of folks might not be aware that sometimes your own worst enemy is your best friend.
That's right.
The people that you think are your real allies are the ones that end up stabbing you in the back. And in New Orleans, it really...
I'm going to tell you, I got so many puncture wounds in my back that you could make a puzzle out of it.
That's Malik, and I think about that often. That you really, in fact, your organization was basically infiltrated by the FBI
from the very beginning.
Yeah, a guy named Brandon Darby, who ended up testifying against a couple other kids that he helped set up, and he got them put in prison because they threw a Molotov cocktail, which was wrong for them to do, but he could have actually steered them away from it. He was in your organization, and it was he was actually steering people away and helping to tear down your organization.
Oh, yes, I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you, Brandon wasn't working alone.
Really? What did you find out about that?
No, I'm just letting you know, Brandon was our Benedict Arnold.
Uh-huh.
So who was the Benedict Arnold and the people's hurricane relief from? And ACORN and all other grassroots organizations. So it was many of Brandon Dawkins, you know, and that's the sad part about it. Even after we found out, because he wasn't an informer, Brandon was a provocateur. He provoked those kids into doing what they'd done. You dig? The same thing that he did here. Nobody is talking about that. Nobody is talking about the infiltration of the federal government coming in after a hurricane. No, not to help our organization that they knew that was meeting the needs of the people, but to destroy it. But listen, it's been 5 years. You know how much money that the government on all three levels have given us?
How much?
I'm going to tell you, if you got over $30, you got more than the government that gave me.
That, and I don't mean to laugh because it's funny, because it's not. It's a tragedy for the work you guys did. You guys got in there, started saving lives. You told these stories on my, you told the story about how it all began on my Saturday morning show. But we got Malik Rahim back on the line. Malik, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right.
Okay,
here,
good. You know, we don't know what happened, if it was somebody or something, but I don't trust those cell phones anyway, or computers, because, you know, they just drop out or fall off, or you never know what. I like that old-fashioned stuff that kind of works all the time, all the time. Anyway, Malik, back to New Orleans now. Your organization caught hell for sure and was infiltrated, but you kept it alive all this time, and these kids keep coming to help you out. That must be amazing to you, huh?
I'm going to tell you, it breaks my heart because, these are the real heroes.
Yeah.
These are the real heroes.
Yeah.
And they're treated like dirt. You know, they're treated like dirt. Nothing is said about the heroes. Right now, listen, we had over 30,000 volunteers at Common Ground.
30,000?
we have helped 500,000 people. There's never been an organization in the history of this nation as great as Common Ground.
There you go.
And I challenge anybody to say that there has been another organization that, in spite of the government, on a local, state, and federal level, has helped 500,000 people in a multitude of services. I challenge any of your listeners to tell the name of one organization that have completed what we have done.
Mm-hmm.
And we wasn't recognized as not at the first anniversary, not at the second, the third, or the fourth, and definitely not at this fifth one.
Well, you know, there might be a silver lining to that dark cloud.
We haven't even received a plaque.
Right. But there might be a silver lining. Yeah, Malik. Okay, one more time. The third time's always a charm. Malik Rahim, are you with us?
Oh, yes, Bird. I'm
okay.
Right.
See, there's we'll just use another cell phone. That's all. Maybe they got a bug in yours.
You think so?
No, I don't. I don't want to perpetuate that. No, Malik, come on. Modern technology is funny. Things happen. Things happen around here sometimes. Computers go down, and I don't.
Well,
I never know.
To me all the time.
I was reading the preface to Van Jones' Green Collar Economy on the mic here, live on the radio one day, and the microphone went out. It stopped working. It just went off. And, I mean, the chief engineer couldn't even tell me why. And I thought, what, the FBI coming here and do something to the mic? But, no, it's just the mic did it. You know, anyway, time is short, so, and I know you're busy, so let's continue with this interview now. Now, Malik, these kids, I think one of the silver linings in this dark cloud that you're going through with this fighting a good fight is these, you're turning out young activists, and they're getting to see how real activism works, and that's that they're going to be fighting for the rest of their lives, and they're never going to be on top, and they don't always win. And matter of fact, that's very rare, but they I think they understand by hanging with you that, or they get a new knowledge by hanging with you that it's just an ongoing struggle that you got to keep going and you can't stop.
But see, Bird, it is sad because
it is.
These young people that I just introduced you to, all of them is under 30, so they. I'm over twice the age.
Sure, and they're the future, right? They're our future.
Most of them, I have, they're about the age of my grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And there's a sad part to it.
What type of world we are leaving them when they reach my age? At 62, how are they going to deal with all these mass antiquated weapons of mass destruction that we're going to leave them as our legacy?
I don't think they're going to let that happen.
How are they going to deal with the pollution that we are causing right now? How are they going to deal with the debt that we are incurring now that they're going to have to pay? I mean, it just was an explosion in San Bruno.
I used to live there.
The infrastructure is failing.
Right.
What's going to happen? And this was during a time that America was doing so well.
Right.
But what's going to happen 40 years from now?
Well, I think these kids...
They say that pipeline was built in 56.
Yeah. Well, now, right? some
so
of it was
talking about maybe 40, 50, what was that?
60 years ago.
Over 50 years from now.
Right.
What's going to happen then?
Yeah. Totally.
Who's going to be able to, how are they going to deal with this?
Yeah, well, you know.
How are they going to deal with the pollution that we are causing this planet? How are they going to be able to deal with a plastic ocean?
The first thing they're going to do is probably lock us up. For leaving them right?
You know, hopefully, I pray that the Lord be and took me away from you. Because I don't want to see it. I don't want to see it like that.
Yeah, but Malik...
I wouldn't want to live in... I hope that I'll be deceived before I see this environment become so toxic that we cannot live in. And that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Everybody's saying the number one issue in America is the economy. Instead of saying that the number one issue with it truly and rightfully should be... is how we going to save our environment.
Right.
You know, and it's sad. I mean, it would be so easy for us to straighten this up. Right now, we have asked, I mean, Hurricane Katrina have taught us nothing. Because right now, we're going back to depending upon a levee system.
Right.
We're not talking about restoring our wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about how can we clean up our environment. We are talking about, you know, well, now we could stop these major oil leaks, and we know that we could clean them up. You know, I mean, someone was asking me today about, as we was coming over here just now, about eating seafood out of the wetlands. You know, and I told them, I won't eat any.
Yeah.
You know, and they tell me about the oil. And I told them, no, it's not the oil, it's the dispersant. Who knows what's going to be the lasting ramification for over 2 million gallons of coaxin 9500.
Yeah.
Nobody can tell you what's going to be the ramification.
That's right.
Because they don't know.
Especially when there's a skull and crossbones on the side of the barrel.
I'm telling you.
Malik Rahim is talking to us live from New Orleans now. And Malik, I don't know if you're aware of this. I'm sure you are. But you've affected a lot of lives. And you've created a lot of activists, that kids that came down and worked with you and went back home. And I think that's something you should be proud of. And I know you're not one to walk around patting yourself on the back or talking about all your personal accomplishments. But, you know, as daunting as this fight seems and as terrible as this whole thing looks, I think you got something to be real proud of. And that's, hey, you know, you changed my life. When I met you, I didn't know anything about what went on down there, and I had you on my radio show, and everybody that listened that day heard it, and they've heard it since, too, and we got a bird's-eye view of what really went on down there, and that's the stuff that brings about change, Malik, and I hope you're...
Listen, let me tell you something. Who really changed lives was Brandon Darby.
Well, he did. He did.
He changed it to the degree.
Yeah.
That right now we are an organization that, yeah, we say this, but we are still a struggling organization.
That's right.
You know, the reason why we had to close down our environmental center, because we couldn't raise $2,500 a month to keep it going.
Mm-hmm. But it's those volunteers.
All that you're saying, you know, I mean, the reason why I had to stop my bike for the Gulf. Because I cycled from Houma, Louisiana, all the way to Pascagoula, Mississippi.
Really?
I couldn't raise $100.
Really?
That's right.
You did a bike ride for the environment?
Yeah. Biking for the Gulf.
This had to be more than just you. It was multiple people?
It was just me.
Just you?
Right. I couldn't get no one to bike with me, but for 2 days.
Man.
So for the rest of the time, I biked alone.
I wish we would have known about that.
I was the only one biking, and I had a support vehicle in the middle of the summer, the hottest summer on record.
Man.
In a car without air conditioning, and then I got one of our old buses without air conditioning.
Man. You did that this summer,
yeah.
Malik?
Huh?
You did that this summer?
Yeah, I just stopped. I just stopped on August the 9th.
Oh, wow.
And the reason why I stopped then, because of my son-in-law passed.
Oh.
You know, and I couldn't even come to California to go to his funeral.
Sorry to hear that. Malik.
Because of the fact that every little cent that we have is so needed for the work that we are doing.
Right.
These guys who come in to help me move, this morning we got into a real conversation about tools. I guess we could call it an argument about tools, because they're working without tools, because an individual like Brandon and their provocateurs came down here and broke everything that we had, or he's allowed individuals to come in and steal them. And now we have guys down here now that's making these sacrifices with nothing.
Okay, Malik,
we don't have nothing.
How can people,
you know,
help?
I mean, it's sad when you see these guys working like this here in a city that will not help them.
Right.
Will not give them a dime. Will not give them a glass of water.
Yeah, that's a shame.
You know, and so, again, when you talk about the people that I've influenced, they sure haven't came back and said, well, hey, Malik, here's a nickel. Because that's all we needed was 100 people.
Right.
Just 100 people to give us $25 a month.
Yeah.
Maybe because of the depression that we are in, nobody can afford $25 a month.
It could
be. But I beg to differ with that when I'm seeing that the Saints is always sold out and they ain't did nothing.
Yeah, right. Malik, Malik.
Where our priority is at. Our priority is not helping. I mean, listen, if there's any young individual that looking at me as an example, then they say, well, I sure better not volunteer for anything. I still been not doing anything because they look at how we're scuffling, you know, to make it in the midst of all this prosperity. You dig? Then they say, because it'd be something different if we was in Ethiopia or in a country that's without funds. We was in Haiti or in Pakistan, but we're right. in America.
Right.
And we're in America, and they could help everybody else, but won't help us.
Well, if there are people listening, Malik, that want to help, how could they help Common Ground Relief right now? What do you need?
They could go online.
Okay.
To commongroundrelief.org.
All right.
They can make a donation over line. They can call the number. What's the number over? It's 504. They could call us.
Is the phone number on the website?
Yeah, the phone number would be on the website.
Okay, they can get there, or they can call.
Either they can write us.
Okay. Or if they want to come down, they can they can help volunteer, right?
Well, it's 504-942-3737.
942-3737 in the 504 area yes. code. All right.
504 area code.
Okay.
And they can help us.
Okay.
I mean, right now we have individuals that is building as working on rebuilding people's houses with nothing. I mean, it shouldn't be that they coming to me and saying, "Well, hey, Malik, can we borrow your compressor?" I mean, I got to go to work now because I got to help my daughter with her children.
Yeah, right.
You know, nobody's talking about helping me.
Yeah.
I done went 5 years I can't even get a driver's license because I'm classified as a deadbeat dad. I couldn't even go to Haiti because I couldn't get a passport
wow.
because I'm classified as a deadbeat dad. With all the people that I don't help, I can't actually get the help on getting a driver's license.
Not good. Malik Rahim has been our guest for the half hour. Malik, I know you're busy. You're moving your environmental center today. I want to thank you for your time. And please, let's stay in touch. And you keep up the good fight. And again, I'm there with you, brother. And I encourage everybody.
All right, thank you.
Everybody,
all
go
right,
on the website,
thanks, my brother. And listen, y'all stay strong.
Thank you. And keep it tight. Okay.
All right.
Peace. That's Malik Rahim. And coming up right now is a record that Mos Def and Trombone Shorty and Lenny Kravitz did called "It Ain't My Fault" about New Orleans. Just Trombone Shorty, Google it up. That's a song they did, and it's all about New Orleans. And right now, ladies and gentlemen, my old dear buddy, Sakada Kone, live from New Orleans. Kone, you there?
I'm live and direct.
All right.
Thank you for the invite once again, and a special welcome to all the good people out there in Northern California. Which I consider my second home.
Yeah,
I've lived out there 8.5-9 years,
yeah.
Approximately, in the Northern California area. That is next to New Orleans. That's home sweet home.
Yeah, you were you lived out here for all that time, and you're original New Orleans resident. You went back. Was it just after Katrina or just before?
Yes, October 2005, right after Katrina. And to be honest with you and your listeners, I really hadn't planned on staying. I put my life in hold in Cali for 3 months, paid my rent 3 months in advance, and got out here and got caught up in the revolution, found out on the ground what the real deal was and the injustices that was been done to New Orleans' original inhabitant, in particular the African-American community, the neglected community, and the attempt by the economic and political establishment to disenfranchise this community. I rolled up my sleeves and decided this is going to be a protracted struggle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm involved, and I'm still here 5 years later.
And what was it you were aiming to do when you went out there?
I was aiming to help family members, relatives, recuperate from the devastation of Katrina. A lot of my family actually lived in various parts of Louisiana and into Texas, so they were also affected by Hurricane Rita,
mm-hmm.
which came 2 weeks after Katrina. So I was kind of spreading myself out in that area. And my buddy, good friend of mine, Malik Rahim, who I actually met in California when he was living out in California. He's originally from New Orleans. One of the co-founders of the original Black Panther Party. He was involved in the 1960s and early 70s. And he stayed. He stayed during Katrina and witnessed and experienced the lack of infrastructure that existed right after, put out an SOS call to everybody that he knew on planet Earth, and including yours truly. And I responded initially for the first month or so by raising money out there in Cali. I was in Cali at the time, first month post-Katrina, raising funds, raising awareness, raising food and water to be sent down. I mean, a group of concerned Northern California folks were embarking upon that. And then subsequent to that, Malik and Common Ground, they launched an organization called Common Ground Relief. They put out another SOS request for assistance because the response was so overwhelming in terms of the volunteers that were coming out. However, a vast majority of those volunteers were young people, 26 and under, and they didn't have experience in community organizing. They didn't have the kind of experience in first respondents, what the first respondents would require in terms of dealing with a catastrophe. And so he put out a call for more experienced veteran community organizers and folks that was involved in that type of endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I got initially involved with Common Ground Relief back in those days.
Now, did you know Brandon Darby?
Yes.
Now you know Darby, it came out later that he had worked for the FBI. Or at least he cooperated with them in another case. But in hindsight, Brandon Darby was a guy who ended up setting up these two kids at the Republican National Convention up in Minnesota. And it's not that he got them to throw Molotov cocktails at police cars, but he drove them up there. And he could have diverted them and got them, told them not to do it, but he didn't. He ended up testifying against them in court. And it turns out he was one of the first members of Common Ground, and in hindsight, Malik said that looking back on the way he acted, and some of his friends at Common Ground said this too, that he was like steering people away from Common Ground, and he was doing skullduggery stuff like that. What's your recollection of Brandon Darby involvement in the early Common Ground?
Brandon Darby never confronted me in doing nefarious activities. However, he confronted other people that were in my charge because I coordinated. I was a project leader at various projects at Common Ground. He would approach people who were my charge that I was essentially supervising, and they would later come back to me in that they said that they were tempted to be pressured by Brandon to join an underground cadre that would attack the police department physically, that would also attack the drug dealers, the gangsters, and so forth, because Brandon's message to them was that the police and the gangsters were, you know, enemies of the community. And you know what? I have to agree, at least with that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But his way of dealing with that is that he's trying to organize and recruiting these 18, 19, 20-year-olds to be a part of an underground cadre to carry on direct physical attacks on these folks. Now, keep in mind, you know, these kids are out here, you know, their parents are already worried about them being in an area where they didn't have very much infrastructure. That's bad enough, you know, but to add insult to injury, here's a guy who's supposed to be a leader in Common Ground, very articulate, and these youngsters were very impressionable. And but they were concerned. I'm so happy that they came back to me and other project leaders and informed us that this guy was trying to do this kinds of things. And unfortunately, we were so overwhelmed with everything else going on at the time that did not take a high priority on our list to deal with that. I wrote it off because I was not that experienced with dealing with agents that infiltrate organizations. And in the case of Brandon, it looked like he was more than an agent. He was an agent provocateur. This is in hindsight, mind you, but I'm not, you know, I'm looking at it in hindsight. At the time, when I was hearing these things, I would approach him, and I just wrote it off that he was hot-headed,
mm-hmm.
you know, a bit unbalanced, and, you know, visions of grandeur, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, they're all these kind of characters. You know, and not having been in organizations like the Black Panthers and, you know, having been too young to be a part of that at the time, I could not, you know, have had the experience to recognize that he had all of the symptoms of a classic agent provocateur. I mean, I found out about it subsequently when I began to read up on those types of characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, you know, sometimes, you know the old saying, you in the forest and you can't see the trees?
Yeah, can't see the forest for the trees.
We were so caught up in the emergencies of the time, trying to help people out, survive, you know, that it was hard to comprehend what this guy was doing. And I guess it was easy for him to do because he recognized we're so preoccupied with other tasks,
mm-hmm.
so that he was able to escape, you know, and do his thing, so to speak.
We're talking to Sakata Kong.
Yeah, that was you know, interesting that it came out that the him being a primary witness against these two young people,
yeah.
At that convention. But my understanding as well is that not only did he drive them, but he helped them procure the material. Because
right.
These 20-year-old youngsters, they didn't know how to make a bomb.
Yeah.
You know, how to make Molotov cocktail. He had to direct them
yeah.
in how to do it. And
yeah.
then he ends up being the star witness.
Yeah,
so, you know, that evidence that came out during that time, subsequently to Common Ground, you know, all of a sudden, you know, we begin to put it all together that, you know, well, we saw similarities with Common Ground.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just lucky. We were just lucky that, you know, it didn't come to a point where our people caught up into that situation by
yeah.
which they would subsequently be prosecuted. We were just purely 100% lucky.
Speaking about Brandon Darby, and Brandon Darby did tell his story to the PBS syndicated talk show This American Life. I heard it one day and I couldn't believe he was talking, and he tried to justify all his actions and say that he was just mixed up and he didn't know what he was doing, and it wasn't that good. But anyway, we're talking right now
before we change the subject over
yeah.
To do what I'm doing these days. This guy was on payroll. We must not forget this. He was on payroll to his handler.
Oh, you mean the FBI payroll? They were giving him money.
The FBI
yeah.
Itself.
Right.
He was receiving a salary.
Yeah, he got his six pieces
right.
of silver, right? He did his
Absolutely.
Judas thing. Yeah, definitely. Sakata Kone is our guest right now. And Sakata, you've been working on another project for the last couple of years. Wesley United is a church in New Orleans, right?
Yeah, so the former Wesley United Methodist Church, which is the second oldest African-American church in New Orleans, or I should say was, because it was decertified as a church by the National Methodist Conference subsequent to its damage during Katrina. But during the time of its existence, it was the second oldest in New Orleans and the eighth oldest overall black church in the United States of America.
Hmm.
And we were concerned that the National Methodists were not putting resources in saving.
Did it get flooded? Did it get damaged during the hurricane?
It got damaged. It got flooded. It got damaged, but not irreparable. You know, with the gutting, which we went on and did, and subsequent repairs, and now we are embarking upon the renovation and restoration of portion of it. We thought that it was necessary to save this institution. You see, the problem is, particularly within our community, I think general communities, period, but particularly within the African-American community, we lose use our history towards various structures that we allow the city officials to condemn and demolish. Wesley has a very lustrous and colorful history. It has been an integral part of the struggle for human rights in New Orleans since its inception for 173 years.
Speak about some of that history. It's got a very rich history, and I'd like you to speak about that.
Absolutely, and that's why, as a result of this history, we feel it has been an inspiration to the community and can continue on to be so as an example on how to fight with a seemingly insurmountable odd and overcome those odds. Wesley was originally built by slaves voluntarily. They would work on it after they came out of the fields in the evening and on the off day, which is on the Sundays. Were working on building that institution in exchange for the opportunity to worship there. In America, there were two Christian denominations that opposed slavery from its inception. One we're very well aware of is the Quakers, because the Quakers were involved in the Underground Railroad. The other denomination, Christian denomination, that opposed slavery were the Methodist Church. As a matter of fact, Wesley is named after John Wesley, the primary co-founder of Methodism. John Wesley, who was out of London, England, was a disillusioned Anglican priest who thought that the Anglican Church, also known as the Church of England, was too cozy with the government, that essentially they would deliver their congregants to the will of the government, and John Wesley opposed that, which is why he and his contemporaries formed it Methodism and advocated separation of church and state. While this was being done in England, he also traveled to what was then known as the New World to set up Methodist churches out here. So if you Google John Wesley, you'll find out that most of his writing was against the institution of slavery from late 1830s up until the day he died in 1893. So Wesley bears that name. Now, once the facility was constructed, the Methodists did keep their word, and Wesley United Methodist Church, when it officially opened in 1844, opened up to a mixed race congregation, one of the few that existed in throughout the entire southern region of the United States, because this is an area of slavery, of legalized slavery. So it was totally unique that this would be an integrated institution made up of African slaves, whites, and free people of color. And the free people of color were either free because they purchased their freedom or they had escaped. And the surrounding swampland afforded them the opportunity to be able to create communities out there in the swampland, along with their indigenous red brothers and sisters out there in the swampland, who had, collectively, they had a common enemy. That was the colonialists and the slavers. And they would unite and fight these folks. But they'd come into New Orleans quite frequently, and they were members of Wesley United. On into 1865, after the Civil War, and I should mention that in the ensuing years from the time the church opened until 1865, Wesley was one of the primary facilities by which the abolitionists, the anti-slave abolitionists, would conduct their meetings and organize and plan how they were going to attack the slave institutions. 1865, right after the Civil War, the then predominantly majority of the African Americans that made up of the membership of Wesley United, these newly freed African slaves, along with their black brothers and sisters that had already freed themselves in one way or another, made up the overwhelming majority of the attendees, and appealed to the National Methodist Conference for the opportunity to run and manage the facility. Unfortunately, the National Methodist Conference were not as enlightened as their local brethren and sisters, white brethren and sisters, and they rejected that request. Now, interesting enough that as opposed to just accepting that willy-nilly, the newly freed, predominantly newly freed African slaves, African Americans, turned around and sued the National Methodist.
How did that work out?
And, well, it is quite interesting because, you see, it was unprecedented to do that. Very few blacks had ever sued a pre-slavery or right off of slavery, any institution, because they knew they wouldn't win. And so, the interesting enough that what occurred was totally unprecedented. They won.
Wow.
They won the right to run the institution, which they did up until Hurricane Katrina in 05. In those ensuing years, Wesley played an integral role, an integral part in the Reconstruction era. In addition to that, immediately following Reconstruction, they participated in the fight against Jim Crow, because as we know, Reconstruction was set back with the Black Codes and the Jim Crow law, where the federal government is essentially pulled back the union protection of the newly freed black slave. They cut a deal with the former plantation owners and essentially gave them autonomy in the certain region, by which they set up their own laws, autonomous laws. They call them states' rights, which is quite interesting because you hear states' rights being bantered about today in most recent month behind the passage of the health care bill, where quite a few states, mostly southern states, and amongst those southern states, mostly those states who were part of the original Confederate States of America, are imploring states' rights that they are not going to implement President Obama's health care. Interesting, huh? In spite of the many years, how things have not changed very much.
Yeah.
So during the years of Jim Crow, legal discrimination, legal racism, legal lynching, Wesley was the primary facility to fight those inhumane laws and to take on those human rights violations head on. On into the 20th century, where Wesley United Methodist Church was a primary facility that involved itself in facilitating the civil rights movement. In addition, I should add that quite a few luminaries that have spoken at Wesley United, including in 1865, Mary Todd Lincoln, for the first time in the entire southern region, the former Confederate States of America, for the first time, the Emancipation Proclamation was read by Mary Todd Lincoln right there at Wesley United Methodist Church. In addition to that, we had the Honorable Marcus Garvey that spoke there in 1920. In 1930s, Mary McLeod Bethune, one of the civil rights leader of that time, a nationally respected educator, spoke there. The classic epic filmmaker of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, Cecil B. DeMille, also spoke there. So Wesley's reputation preceded itself nationally so that anybody of note coming through town tried their best to have the opportunity to speak at that facility because of what it had represented historically, and that is one of the leaders in the fight for human rights and human dignity, specifically in New Orleans, but in the entire southern region of the United States.
We're hearing from Sakada Kode, who's involved in the struggle in New Orleans, a resident from there originally, and struggling today to try to keep this great old institution, this church, Wesley United Methodist Church, alive. And is there a chance that the parent organization might just let this church go?
Well, it has, in theory, because they didn't expend the resources to repair it post-Katrina. They had many churches, not only Methodist churches, but of all denominations that was damaged all along the Gulf Coast region. And, of course, with limited resources, they had to do a cut cost-benefit analysis to see what they was going to retain and what they was going to let go. Unfortunately, Wesley did not make that cut. Our vision for Wesley in this community, and this community has suffered greatly post-Katrina, and the community I'm referring to is Central City, New Orleans.
That's a part of town it's in.
Yes, and Central City, New Orleans is the second oldest black community in New Orleans, second only to the Treme. The Treme is not only the oldest black community in New Orleans, it is the oldest African-American community in the United States of America.
Did Treme get flooded?
Yes, Treme did get flooded.
Yes,
but because of its proximity to what is considered high land, it only sustained a few feet of water.
Oh, okay.
About three and a half feet of water.
We just got a couple of minutes left. Did Treme come back like it was before?
No. Very few communities come back like it was before. Only the two richest communities have come back to that, and that's the French Quarter and the Garden District being the richest and whitest residential district in New Orleans. But all the other communities are still struggling, more or less, to come back.
And they don't look
now,
the same. They don't look the same.
Was going to offer the website so people can find much more what we're doing. But Wesley, please do go to www.SaveWesleyUnited.org. SaveWesleyUnited. Wesley is spelled WESLEY, United.org. And for those of you who don't have computers, give us a call. Area code 504-861-5017.
That's great. Give that number one more time, Sakana.
504-861-5017. Save Wesley United, New Orleans, and find out how you can participate and our endeavor to save this very impressive, prominent, and inspiring institution.
That's great. Sagar, I can't thank you enough for your time.
It's always good to be with you and your listening audience, man.
Definitely.
You know, I mean, even though I cannot be there physically, you know, I'm feeling really good in terms of the vibes.
Good.
The vibes are always fantastic. I look forward to doing these interviews with you.
Yes, great. And we got to keep the fight up together, using the radio waves and using you, the power on the ground down there, and try to get this back to where it needs to be.
Yes, sir. I'm in total agreement. Yes, sir. Thank you so much, and a farewell to all of you all. I look forward to future conversations with you and your audience.
Thank you, Sagar. You have a great day, okay?
You too.
Peace.
Peace.
Sakana Kone, SaveWesleyUnited.org is the website. Check it out if you think you can help or you want to. There's still a lot of work to do to try to get New Orleans back on its feet for the real folks.